in other areas as well, that where you'd have to do a lot more than just this in order to explain it. The hermeneutics that he will offer in the next part, what we're reading for next week in this chapter, is a hermeneutic for reading philosophical texts. It's not a hermeneutic for reading literary texts or poetry or anything like that. It's a hermeneutic for reading philosophy. I think that's important to emphasize that. But at least with respect to that particular discipline, he'll say that it is a function of this. And the repetition is a function of this. That it is extremely difficult for any of us to stay in that pattern and to keep the unity and the direction of that pattern in mind constantly, either in our lives or even in our, not only in our lives, but even in our intellectual work, we can slip aside from it very easily. But, you know, there are a lot of other things where there's a lot more that would have to be taken into account. I find, for instance, that René Girard on myth and religion and so on, he's got an awful lot to teach us about the patterns that continually are operative in human religious behavior that are really destructive patterns. And we've got to learn. And he learns a lot from the gospel as overcoming. But he learned that as he did his studies. But he's really convinced that the suffering servant and the paschal mystery in the gospel is the solution to religious operation. But only when it itself is rightly understood, because it itself can become an aberration, entering into it. We can enter into it from a standpoint that is missing, the longer than sense of the term, rather than mystery.
I'm just not sort of thinking off the top of my head, but is there an isomorphism with sort of an anti of this? I'm not sure what the right term would be. Going back to the biases and the scotomas and all of that, is there a counter force going on with all of this that continues to lead us away or continues to try to break this pattern? You know, I'm thinking of, like, when he talks about, you know, different patterns of existence, you know, it's so easy, as you're saying, to fall back into the animal pattern, just to have to be concerned. And there's so many people who just have to be concerned.
They have to be, and there's a time for that. There's a time for each of those patterns of experience, but where the appropriate response is in the biological or the dramatic or the aesthetic or whatever. So there is a time for all of those. And there's a self-transcendence that can be reached in all of those patterns. The biological is very spontaneous kind of thing, but the aesthetic and the dramatic, there's a self-transcendence that can be reached.
But there are certain social forces at work within certain communities that never allows them to really get beyond the biological or aesthetic.
No, absolutely right. That's part of the mystery of evil in our world, is that people are, the conditions are such that it's extremely statistically improbable that they will be able to emerge into the kind of person that he's talking about. Way in which their lives have been already negatively affected by the dialectics of community and culture. Definitely, there's no question about that. But even with those of us who have been more fortunate along those lines, there is the wonderful expression in Rahner of gnosiological concupiscence. Rahner, as I said once, could come up with a term like that. But basically what he's referring to is the effect of the theological reality that we call concupiscence on our knowing process itself, how we are very easily diverted away from what Lonergan would articulate in this way. It's a function of the sin of the world as it has affected us. And that's what concupiscence is in general. It's a function of the sin of the world as it has affected us, and it has affected us in terms of the scattered and the fragmented and the not staying with the questions.
So Bob, do I have this right, and this term refers to a running away from the truth?
In osteological concupiscence, what Rahner means by it is that we lose we slip off the path towards truth. You know, in the terms of Lonergan's cognitional theory, we stop asking the questions, or we get diverted somewhere along the line, or we get stuck somewhere, or we move away, or we fall back into this. We fall back into mythic consciousness, that the criterion of the real is the intensity of emotion, which is basically what we're going to see here with number 7 on page 3 in the notes. We set up a different criterion of the real from the one of are there further questions or not. So if I could look here, if you could look just for a moment at number 3, I'm going to skip a lot of this material because it's just summarizing what's in the book, what I presume that you've already read. But the quote that I have in number 7 on page 3 of the notes, line 3, and this is exactly a partial answer to Dorothy's question here. Mythic consciousness would be an example of what Rahner's talking about. One example of it, it's not the only one. It experiences and imagines, understands and judges, but it doesn't distinguish between these activities, and so it's incapable of guiding itself by the rule that the impalpable act of rational assent to sufficient evidence, okay, is the necessary and sufficient condition for knowledge of reality. What's the necessary and sufficient condition for what is? Grasping sufficient evidence. And that's an impalpable act. Sometimes it's not always accompanied by a great hoopla of emotion. It can simply be, there are no further questions on this issue. And I know there are. For mythic consciousness, the real is the object of a sufficiently integrated and a sufficiently intense flow of sensitive representations, feelings, words, and actions at this level. That was real, man. This is especially true when unanalyzed consciousness is orientated into the strange realm of the knowing unknown. If someone, for instance, tries to tell you, as I have had someone try to tell me, that things that I'm experiencing in my life right now are a function of the fact that in a previous life, I was, and they had this vision of things that I had done in a previous life. And I want to say, how the hell do you know that? What is the evidence? But he's got and it's a sufficiently intense flow of sensitive representations, feelings, words, and actions that make all kinds of sense to him in explaining my present behavior. That's mythic consciousness. There is no evidence for that. None whatsoever. That's just unanalyzed consciousness oriented into the strange realm of the known unknown and coming up with images for which it has no evidence of their pertaining to the fact, to what is. So without a distinction between insight and presentations here, insight, one is apt to attribute explanatory power to presentations and their associated feelings and emotions. We do the same in our own anthropomorphic projections onto nature, he's got examples there, and subjective projections onto other people. We can project all kinds of things onto other people, for which, when, if we can gain a state of emotional objectivity, we have to admit there's something no evidence. And without a firm grasp of the heuristic character of human intelligence, anticipation of insight can pass for insight itself, and partial insight for mastery. And this is particularly true when you get people who are very articulate, very glib, and they can convey the impression that they're understanding a lot, but all they basically, what they're able to do is to manipulate words. So, myth, in this pejorative sense, and metaphysics, in the sense of the heuristic structure of what is, are opposites. And as metaphysics advances, myth recedes. And metaphysics advances as we come to know ourselves better. But myth has a permanent basis in polymorphic consciousness. And that's why even in a society like ours, you will find a lot of the movement into this direction. This is not something that simply exists in pre-scientific cultures and so on. There's a permanent task of overcoming the mythic tendency in this pejorative sense by metaphysics. Outside the field of philosophy, this is a quote from page 567, there is the problem of human development that arises with each new generation. Because people do not develop intellectually, or if they do, because they become involved in covert positions, they cannot be dealt with on the basis of intelligence and reason. This makes it all the easier to deal with them on the sensitive level. And now you've got here your power people, the people who come along, and the demagogues and so on, to capture their imaginations, to whip up their emotions, to lead them to action. Power in its highest form is power over. The successful maker of myths has that power within his reach and grasp, think of Hitler. But clearly, if an adequate metaphysics can do something to overcome philosophic misinterpretations of the notion of myth, it needs to be extended into a philosophy of education, and the education has to be made effective before there can be exorcised the risk of adventurers climbing to power through sagacious myth-making. Think of the Jonestown stuff, for instance. Remember the Jonestown when they drank the poison, the whole community killed themselves a number of 10 years ago. So it's all mystic consciousness brought on by the power of someone who was able to manipulate the people at the level of emotional view. Okay, but that's not the only thing that there is between the level of psyche and open question. There is a correspondence on the psychic level to the known unknown on the intellectual level, and Montague calls it mystery. There is a psychic correspondence to the open question, and it's the attitude of mystery. That attitude of mystery cannot be eliminated from human living, both because there is always the further question, and because explanation doesn't give us a hope. Explanatory understanding gives us understanding. It doesn't give us hope. We need hope. Our explanatory self-knowledge can become effective in our concrete living. So even the self-appropriation of the norm, only if the content of systematic insights, the direction of judgments, the dynamism of decisions can be embodied in images that release feeling and emotion, flow spontaneously into deeds no less than words. Even the achievement of full understanding and the attainment of the totality of correct judgments would not free us from the necessity of dynamic images that partly are symbols and partly are signs. And that's what he means by mysteries. And he's got this lengthy quotation which I just typed out completely here because I think it's with our attending to conclude this section. Because human understanding and judgment, decision and belief, right, and the whole realm of what he's calling the spiritual, because those are the higher integration of sensitive contents and activities, the origin, the expression, and the application, origin, expression, application, before, during, after, intelligent and rational contents and directives, for instance, what I hold to be true, what I believe to be true, the origin of that and the expression of it and the application of it lies in the sensitive field. Think of even how you came to faith, right? It came through stories that were told to you by people who loved you. I would almost in every instance, all right? The origin was in the sensitive field. There was an affect that was opened up in you, and the application of your faith is in the sense of the field and your loving deeds and so on and so forth. There is the whole sense of the component to it. But nonetheless, you are at times making affirmations that themselves may be extremely spiritual. I believe in God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, for instance. So there's that integration of the two. Because the integrating activities of the intellectual level and the integrated activities of the sensitive level form a dialectical unity of tension, it follows, number one, that the intellectual activities, questioning, inquiry, insight, reflection, judgment, are either the proper unfolding of the detached and disinterested desire to know, or else a distorted unfolding due to the interference of other desire and bias, and so on. And secondly, that the sensitive activities from which the intellectual contents emerge, images, feelings, sensations, and in which they are represented, expressed, and applied, either are involved in the mysteries of the proper unfolding or distort these mysteries into myths. Because we develop in self-knowledge, we distinguish between our sensitive and intellectual activities with increasing sharpness and exactitude. And we grasp with ever greater precision their interrelations and interdependence. And so our advance in self-knowledge implies an increasing consciousness and deliberateness and effectiveness in our choice and use of dynamic images of mottos and slogans. There's a great deal of work that's been done on Plato's refinement of the use of symbols and myth in his dialogues. That would be an instance of the kind of thing that Lonergan's talking about here. An increasing consciousness and deliberateness and effectiveness in his choice and use of dynamic images, models, and slogans to convey the truth of what he had come to see. Finally, this advance implies not a rationalist sublation of both mystery and myth, but simply a displacement of the sensitive representation of spiritual issues. Because counterpositions head to their own reversal, and myths are grounded in counterpositions, sooner or later every myth is discredited. Because we cannot renounce intelligence or repudiate reasonableness, every occasion on which a myth is discredited is also an opportunity for us to advance towards a profounder self-knowledge, a more exact grasp of science and metaphysics, a more conscious use of mystery, purified of myth. Because the union of sensitive and intellectual activities is a unity of opposites in tension. Because the dominion of the detached and disinterested desire constantly is challenged. The elimination of one myth tends to coincide with the genesis of another. And the advance of science and philosophy, this is coming to Sean's question here, implies merely that the later myths will be complemented and defended by appropriate philosophies and made effective through the discoveries of science and the intentions of technology. Inventions, that should be inventions of technology. So we are brought to the profound disillusionment of modernity and to the focal point of its horror. We had hoped through knowledge to ensure a development that was always progress and never decline. We have discovered that the advance of human knowledge is inevitable, and it places in our hands stupendous power without necessarily adding proportionate wisdom and virtue. But the fact of advance and the evidence of power are not guarantees of truth. Myth is the permanent alternative to mystery, and mystery is what our hubris had objected. But there is an issue there of the discernment of the value of the symbols that inform and constitute our living. That's the issue that he raised in this question here. And what is the main thing is to keep in mind the correspondence between this openness at the psychic level, the openness that he's referring to as the attitude of mystery, and the openness of the pure desire at the intellectual level, the correspondence between them. We are not pure intellect, but we also feel that openness. That's the statement that he's making. It's the same openness experienced at the level of the question and at the level.
I'm just wondering about this. I'm wondering about a few things, actually, but just to get the argument right. So there's this kind of a binary opposition then between myth and metaphysics, and that is defined according to the fact that myth departs from the isomorphism, or the structure, the integral heuristic structure of proportionate being. Is that correct? So I'm just wondering about, like, you're talking about past lives, people that are talking about past lives and these kind of things, and recognizing myth kind of distortion in that, these sense. where are they getting these images and these kinds of things? And it just calls to mind, to me, because I've met people that I thought are just shysters in this sense, but I've also met people that bear a certain amount of authenticity.
That's right.
Read Teresa Avila, talks about levitation, and, you know, people that have undergone all kinds of things that I don't know where they're getting the images from. So that's one question. In relation to that, you talked about faith, and I was in a conversation with a fellow like 2 weeks ago, and he referred to Christianity as a death cult that he's just completely discounted. It's, you know, we were in a conversation about this.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, like, to him, like, me talking about Christian faith and the gospel was pure myth, a distortion of what is rationally acceptable even as a proposal. I'm just wondering if you could, like, address these kinds of things.
Thanks. it's a tremendous issue of discernment in all of these questions. This is the point, I mean, the point that's being made in this section of the book is just to call to our attention that there is a permanent need for discernment in these areas, and some kind of indication as to a way in which we can see our way through the discernment of these questions. The only thing that I was getting at was the issue on the, because there are a number of authentic human beings who hold for reincarnation, but, I mean, who are very, very good people, and I was not at all, I was trying to get at something that was said to me about a whole bunch of images that came to somebody that all of a sudden were being apodictically used as an interpretation of events in my own present life. And I'm just saying there is no, you can't do that. There is no way in which you can get any kind of awareness of that sort of thing. And I felt that I was being manipulated.
Yeah.
And I think I was. I mean, I think he was trying to be. And that's the kind of mythmaker that Lauren is talking about here, that it can be extremely dangerous when a person is that glib and that good with words and so on. On the issue of Christianity, how do they understand Christianity?
Yeah.
I just read something in the paper this morning with regard to the new Mel Gibson movie that you know, somebody said, well, you know, you got to realize that Christianity is founded in blood sacrifice. If you read René Girard, and you take Girard's notion of that the incarnate word, and Jesus for Girard is the incarnate word of God. He's very extremely orthodox and Catholic. The revelation is moving beyond. It's precisely that the blood sacrifices are over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that the whole meaning of the blood sacrifice, namely the selection of a surrogate victim to take the load off the guilt of the community, is finished with this act, you know, but it's the appropriation of Christianity that that is a death cult. There has been an appropriation of Christianity that is a death cult, and if that's what this guy is reacting to, he's right. He's right to react to that. But there's a whole understanding of it, and I'm entering it more now, more and more through Girard, that the whole realm of the use of religion for violence is finished with this deed. It's over, and now religion can be the reception of the gift of the love of God into our lives and living for that, not using religion for violence. But it's been used, and it's used over and over and over again. The whole question of whether, I haven't seen Gibson's movie yet, I was supposed to go last night, but it was canceled out, but the whole question of whether it's anti-Semitic or not seems to me to be irrelevant. The issue is, what does authority do when it's threatened? And it just happens to me that these authorities were Jewish. But it's what authority does. And this is the whole thing with Girard. Authority, when it's threatened, kills. And it doesn't make any difference whether they were Jewish or Catholic or Muslim or whatever. Authority destroys when it's threatened, unless it catches itself before it does pass. It's not that it's anti-Semitic, it's saying what happens to power when power is threatened. Does that make any sense?
But what I
would say is this, I mean, what Christianity is he talking about? Is he talking about a misappropriation of the meaning of this deed? And God knows it has been misappropriated and misused. Or is he talking about, and then Teresa, she did let her paint. Okay, I mean, she did. It doesn't happen to a lot of people, but it did happen to her, you know. And it seems like, I mean, people saw her. There she goes, you know, she's off the ground. Okay.
I'm just, in talking about this as a kind of a heuristic for discernment, just bringing these issues up just to say that, you know,
it's
very difficult.
It's
like,
extremely touchy business.
Difficult in the sense that, you know, I felt a bit queasy because I could see this being used by people to say, well, it's myth, see, you're out the door, and, you know, that's this, and you know what I'm saying?
Yes, like, I know what you're saying, but the point... the point I think that he's trying to make is that it is an issue for delicate discernment, and that some of this might help see how they see way through. And it's like the criteria that he, right away in the next section, he starts the next section with the expression, the issue then is truth. Okay? And I don't know the exact words. This is right after this discussion.
572.
The real issue then is truth. How do you determine the truth? What is the criterion of truth? What is truth? How does it come to expression? And so on. But the point on the material in the first part is the delicacy of the discernment of these symbolic expressions. And the need to develop what I would call a heart and a psyche that are in tune with the detachment and disinterestedness of the pure desire. So that, because it's going to be largely out of the heart that you're going to be able to discern. Yes,
I just would add that probably dealing with any kind of myth, I guess, you can't eliminate it directly. So you have to go around somehow. Like in this case, I had also a conversation about this movie I haven't seen yet, but just that the focus is on crucifixion only, basically, or mainly about that. That can result in kind of distortion of Christianity. Christianity is about, because then you have to also deal with the incarnation and the
resurrection
together with the crucifixion. If you eliminate some of these, you get the distortion.
Certainly, if the resurrection is not in there, then it's a real distortion. This is one mystery.
Apparently, it's there. I mean,
yeah, it is.
Yeah,
I hear
it's just.
Yeah, it's there. I've seen it.
Oh, he saw it.
I saw last August. I was one of the test audiences.
Oh.
So you didn't tell?
You didn't read it.
One of those Jesuits whose help is acknowledged.
That's right.
Is your name in the credits?
I didn't see the final credits. That's why I'll go check.
Advisor.
Have I satisfactorily spoken to the issues that you've raised? Because I don't intend this, and he doesn't intend it, to be sort of a brush off of it's raising the issue of the delicacy of the discernment of these kinds of issues, religious and symbolic and ritualistic and all of that, everything that's raised by those.
Yeah.
That they can neither be wholeheartedly embraced or wholeheartedly rejected simply because they are they're symbolic or they're that's the only point I was trying to make sure.
In trying to put this into dialogue with a lot of where we are today, postmodernism, there's a fascinating line I saw at the bottom of 568. For just as it is true that nearly all we say is metaphor. Last line on 568.
Yeah.
I suppose we're at a point now where there are those who would argue that all we say is metaphor. And the myth really here has been replaced with the word poetics, and metaphysics is poetics too. And he seems to have set these at odds with each other. And now they've sort of been elided. It's all myth, it's all poetics. My understanding of a lot of the postmodern position is that there's experience understanding. There's not really understanding, it's all misunderstanding. And you never get to judgment. Is Lonergan's point that, well, without realizing it, a lot of the postmodernists have got to judgment, they just won't acknowledge it? Or, if this is what a philosophy is postmodernism not a philosophy because it denies judgment?
Well, what he would say, and I think it depends on who you would be talking about here, but what he would say is, this would be a good test for the claim that he's making,
right,
is that any philosophy, implicit or explicit philosophy, can be adjudicated on the basis of this,
mm-hmm,
so that you can come to some kind of understanding of it. Now, and it may very well be that you expressed it in terms of, well, they experience and they do have some understanding, but they say that almost all understanding is misunderstanding, and they never really acknowledge judgment. That might be. I don't know. I'm not sure. I haven't read a lot of the people that you're talking about. I can read Levinas and come away feeling very expanded, and I have a tough time with Derrida. I don't know where he's going. I just can't follow him at all. And I've got to give him more of a chance, I guess, but I haven't given him a chance yet. Who is it that you're talking about?
Well, I was thinking of Derrida, and then a lot of the literary criticism that's come down from Derrida, which is in many ways very sloppy and poorly used Derrida in some regards, but a lot of the literary critics, especially today, will say that all understanding is really misunderstanding, and so therefore I'm wondering if you put these things in dialogue, is the ultimate conclusion that either they've made a judgment that all understanding is misunderstanding, and they don't acknowledge that, or from Lonergan's position, say that they don't really come up to the level of a philosophy because they deny the idea of judgment.
No, I don't think the second. I don't think the second is correct, because there are a number of, like, idealism doesn't acknowledge the constitutive role of judgment, but that doesn't mean it isn't a philosophy. What he's saying is that a philosophy can be adjudicated on this basis. Okay, so that this provides a basis for our understanding of what's going on in other philosophies. And it's the question of where is the philosophy, what does that philosophy say about each one of these three levels? That's the point he's making, that you can correctly understand another philosophy by asking what it says about each of those. And then you can make your own evaluation of that philosophy in terms of whether or not you find it harmonious with what you have affirmed about experience and understanding and judgment. So the fact that a philosophy will not acknowledge judgment doesn't mean it isn't a philosophy. It just means that that has to be part of what you take into account as you do your own monitoring and adjudication of that particular philosophy.
Can you say something then about this metaphor, nearly all that we say is metaphor?
Pardon me?
Just it is true that nearly all we say is metaphor. Can you say something about it?
Well, I could say a lot more about it if I knew more about the origins of language and that sort of thing, because I think that Kassirer in the Philosophy of Symbolic Forms, I mean, this may be where Lonergan is getting this, because he didn't read Kassirer carefully, has a long, lengthy analysis of how language emerged and evolved. And I think he puts a great deal of emphasis on the metaphorical transpositions that take place in language. And even the presentation of philosophical positions is metaphorical. We're using a spatial metaphor all the time to talk about levels of consciousness. Well, there aren't really levels, if you know, in any literal sense, it's metaphorical. And even if you do intertwining circles or whatever instead, like the logo that we have at the Lonergan Research Institute now is four intertwining semicircles. And it's the four levels of consciousness, but it's not like this, but they're But that's it's all metaphorical. There aren't circles of consciousness either, in a non-metaphorical sense. I don't know what more to say about that, because I'm just not.
What is the, if nearly all is metaphor, what's not, what language is not metaphor?
Well, I think, and when he was writing this, he would have said that the language of theoretical physics is not metaphorical. Now, there are contemporary science philosophers of science who will, and including someone like Pat Healy, who is very much rooted in Lonergan, who will say that there's a hermeneutics that has to be brought on the scientific expression that is every bit as sophisticated as the hermeneutics of philosophical text or the hermeneutics of symbolic text and so on. So there's a whole movement in the interpretation of scientific discourse beyond what Lonergan was familiar with when he wrote this. So I think he would have said there that, well, I mean, Lindsay and Margulow's Foundations of Physics, which is the main text that we used for the first five chapters, is not metaphor. I think that's probably what he would say.
Neither is ostension.
Is?
Ostension. We agree by convention to use the word red for what we perceive as red. That's not metaphor. When we describe the real out there now,
yeah,
we do it by convention. It's not metaphorical.
Convention.
I didn't
get your word.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. We're at 4 o'clock, so the real issue is truth. The real issue is that we're all going to be in the class. So we'll start with this, and then do the hermeneutic part next week, and then
the land of the
world. The second part of the chapter.
Sorry, Mom.
No, you're
back. Could you boil down to me or hit me with
easy
doesn't he say in one place?
True. Here's a
truth.
Oh, the rabbit's gone.